Let's turn to Acts chapter 14. Remember, by way of review, we looked at the gospel going to Iconium last time, and we noticed the reaction in Iconium in verses 1 through 4 of chapter 14. And the pattern here was exactly the same as the pattern was down at Antioch. In verse 1, or chapter 14, in verse 1, it says, "In Iconium, they entered the synagogue of the Jews together and spoke in such a manner that a large number of people believed, both of Jews and of Greeks. But the Jews who disbelieved stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and embittered them against the brethren." And that's the pattern that we see and we will see again in the book of Acts, that Paul and Barnabas, they go and proclaim the gospel. People believe. In fact, a lot of people believe. And then the Jews who don't believe get upset, and they take steps to have Paul and Barnabas taken out of the picture. And the way they do this is they try to prejudice the civil authorities against the church and against Paul and Barnabas. And we'll see this pattern repeated over and over again in the book of Acts. So the way they do it, the way they try to provoke this Gentile action or action from the civil authorities is by convincing the Roman authorities that Christianity is not a religion that's protected under Roman law. So in other words, it's a religio illicita, as it's called. And they do this by saying that Christianity is no longer a sect of Judaism. Now it's a complete religion to itself. And Judaism, as you know, was protected under Roman law, and the Roman authorities wouldn't have done anything if it was Jews bickering against each other. But now the Jews say, well, Christians are a separate group. Look at chapter 16 over when we get to Philippi in verse 19 through 21. You see that. In verse 19, it says, "But when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them to the marketplace before the authorities. And when they had brought them to the chief magistrates, they said, 'These men are throwing our city into confusion, being Jews, and are proclaiming customs which it is not lawful for us to accept or to observe, being Romans.'" So they were appealing to Roman law to get the Gentile authorities up in arms against the church. And we see this at Thessalonica, we see it at Corinth, and we see it again and again as Paul carries the gospel throughout the world. Now, in verse 6 and 7 of Acts chapter 14, last time we noticed there was a plot against Paul. In verse 6, it says, or verse 5, is the plot. It says, "And when an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to mistreat and to stone them." Now again, stoning them is not something that they did to, the way I said it last week was they don't stone people till they're black and blue. They stone them till they're dead. It was a plot to kill these guys. So they were fleeing for their very lives. And in verse 6 and 7, we set the stage for this evening when it says, "They became aware of it and fled to the cities of Laconia, Lystra, and Derbe, and the surrounding region. And there they continued to preach the gospel." So that brings us to Lystra, where we start tonight. But just before we leave Iconium, there's an interesting fact in the trip to Iconium, and I'm going to get a book that I forgot to bring out here. Paul's stay in Iconium provides us, or gives us, a description of the Apostle Paul. And it's in a book that's called The Acts of Paul and Thelka. It's not a biblical book. It's an extra-biblical book. But it has a description of Paul, and we kind of get an idea of what Paul looked like from this description. And again, it's not the Bible. You can take it or leave it. But as F.F. Bruce says in his commentary, it's a description so vigorous and unconventional that it must surely rest upon a good local tradition of what Paul looked like. In other words, if someone was going to describe a hero, he wouldn't describe him this way unless he really looked this way, is kind of the idea. So we get the description, and it says, "One Onesiphorus, a resident in Iconium, sets out to meet Paul, who was on his way to the city. And he saw Paul approaching, a man small in size, with meeting eyebrows, with a rather large nose, bald-headed, bow-legged, strongly built, full of grace, for at times he looked like a man, and at times he had the face of an angel." So you can picture Paul, this short, bald-headed, bow-legged guy with eyebrows that meet across the top. And anyway, again, you can take that or leave it. It's a description that we have when Paul was in Iconium. That description was written. So with that in mind, with a picture now of the Apostle Paul in our minds, we can move on to Lystra. And now the gospel will travel to Lystra, and we'll look at the map in a minute. The events at Lystra have three parts. It breaks down into three parts. There'll be a miracle, the reaction to the miracle, and then a sermon. The miracle is in verse 8 through 10. Let's read this section now. Starting at verse 8, it says, "At Lystra, a man was sitting who had no strength in his feet, lame from his mother's womb, who had never walked. This man was listening to Paul as he spoke, who, when he had fixed his gaze on him and had seen that he had faith to be made well, said with a loud voice, 'Stand upright on your feet.' And he leaped up and began to walk." Now the reaction in verse 11 to 13, "When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they raised their voice, saying in the Lyconian language, 'The gods have become like men and have come down to us.' And they began calling Barnabas Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds." Now the sermon in verse 14 through 18, which is actually the reaction to these guys trying to worship the apostles, and it's a correction in verse 14. It says, "But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their robes and rushed out into the crowd, crying out and saying, 'Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you, and preach the gospel to you, that you should turn from these vain things to a living God, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways, and yet he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. Even saying these things, with difficulty, they restrained the crowds from offering sacrifice to them." Here's our map. Remember, we started off clear over here at Antioch, down to Cyprus, and then up to Pamphylia, and then up to Antioch, Pisidian Antioch, and then over to Iconium, and that's where we left off last week. And this would be the Galatian territories, the Galatian provinces. And now we're going down from Iconium down to Lystra, and then over to Derbe. So this is where we are in the missionary journey. We're nearing the end of the first missionary journey, going one way. Of course, then Paul will retrace his steps down to Pamphylia and then take a boat over to Seleucia and up to Antioch then. Okay, let's go back to the text, and starting at verse 8, we'll look first at the miracle. And the first thing we want to notice about this is that Paul has a new audience here, and we see that down at verse 11, but we'll apply it to verse 8 through 10. In verse 11, verse 11 says, "When the crowds saw what Paul had done." Now it's the crowds. Remember back at Cyprus in chapter 13, look back at chapter 13 and verse 5, and we established a pattern, and we said that Paul had a habit, and what he did when he got to a new city was he went down to the synagogue and he proclaimed the gospel there in chapter 13 and verse 5. It says, when they reached Salamis, they began to proclaim the word of God in the synagogues of the Jews. So they're proclaiming in the synagogues in Antioch in chapter 13 and verse 16. It says, Paul stood up and motioning with his hand, said, "Men of Israel, and you who fear God." Remember, his audience was Jews and God-fearers. That would be the Gentiles who were attracted to Judaism. In chapter 14, verse 1, in Iconium, the same pattern. In Iconium, they entered the synagogue of the Jews together. So their practice or their habit was to go into the synagogue and proclaim the gospel. Well, now, as they get down to Lystra, we find out that they heal a guy in the streets, and their audience is now the crowds. They have their first, what you could call, a pagan audience. They weren't Jews. They weren't God-fearers. They were just pagans. Now, apparently there wasn't a synagogue in Lystra, or I assume Paul would have done the same thing. He'd have gone down there. But now, he heals a guy, and the crowds draw around. Now, Paul is going to do something. He has a different audience now. It's a totally pagan audience. And he's going to approach the proclamation of the gospel a little bit differently to this crowd. And we'll see that a little more later. But just to kind of get you ready for this, Paul is going to do something a little different here with this crowd. Now, as we look at the healing in verse 8 through 10, we find that there's a very, very strong similarity to the healing that Peter did back in Acts chapter 3. Look back at Acts chapter 3, and we'll kind of flip back and forth a minute between these two healings. And we're going to notice some things that are very similar, and it's kind of apparent that Luke is bringing out this similarity. Remember, back in Acts chapter 3, we have the first proclamation of the gospel, the opening day, so to speak, of the church age. And in chapter 3, verse 2, it talks about a man who had been lame from his mother's womb. And if you look at Acts chapter 14 and verse 8, you have exactly the same expression describing the lame guy over here, lame from his mother's womb. It's identical. And also the participle fixed his gaze on him. In Acts chapter 3, verse 4, it says, Peter, along with John, fixed his gaze on him. And then in Acts chapter 14 and verse 9, this man was listening to Paul as he spoke, who, when he had fixed his gaze on him, again, the same participle used to describe fixing their gaze upon him. In both cases, the man didn't just get up and hobble off. He leaped up. In chapter 3, verse 8, it says, with a leap he stood upright and began to walk. And the exolomai is the Greek word there. And then in chapter 14, verse 10, it says, stand upright on your feet, and he leaped up and began to walk. Holomai is the word there. It's from the same root, a very similar word that means to leap up. And the words walking in 3:9, where it says all the people saw him walking, and then over in 14:10, where it says he began to walk. Again, the same word. So we have lots of similarities between these two accounts of the healing of the lame man. First one done by Peter, of course, and now this one done by Paul. As we look at the reaction in verse 11 to 13, though, in chapter 14, we're going to find a very, very different reaction. Now, back in Acts chapter 3, the reaction was that many came to believe that day, and the messengers, Peter and the apostles went to jail. That was the reaction there. And that was a good reaction. They had a lot of people, believers, become believers. Now in Acts chapter 14, what's going to happen, rather than a bunch of people becoming believers, they're going to deify the messengers. So we have a very bad result over in chapter 14. So the miracles are very similar. The results are quite different. Now here, Paul and Barnabas in chapter 14 are going to be identified in terms of the pagan religions. And remember, they have a purely pagan crowd now that's listening to them. And they're going to identify Barnabas as Zeus. Verse 12, it says, and they began calling Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. Now Zeus was the king of the Greek gods. Paul is identified as Hermes. He was the herald of the gods in the Greek god system. So they identified these people. Now a note on the text, if you're reading King James, and I don't know if anybody here is reading King James tonight, but in the Greek text, the gods are named Zeus and Hermes, or the Greek equivalents, it's Zeus and Hermes. But in the King James Version, it has Barnabas being called Jupiter and Paul being called Mercurius. I just wanted to explain that in case someone's looking at a different text. There's not a difference in the Greek text behind those two translations. What it is it follows an old custom. And the old custom was when translating Greek into English, when they came to a Greek proper name like Zeus or Hermes, what they did was they changed it to the Latin word, the Latin equivalent. So the Latin king of the gods was Jupiter, and the Latin messenger god was Mercurius. Mercury, remember, he had the little flat wings on his feet. He was the messenger god. So it's not a difference in the Greek text. It's just a difference in the way they chose to translate. It's an old custom of changing proper names into the Latin equivalents. Now, we can make a note here on the miracles as well. Something you might find rather odd is that, you know, miracles do not always produce good results. Back in chapter 3, the results of the miracle of the healing of the lame man were very, very good. A lot of people came to believe. Of course, the messengers were thrown in jail, but a lot of people became believers that day. Now here, the results aren't so hot, are they? What happens when they do a miracle? The people start worshiping Paul and Barnabas. So we can make two observations about miracles. First, they don't always have positive results. And second, they are never, ever, ever intended to glorify the messenger. Look at verse 15. In Acts 14, 15, it says, they're saying, men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you. So Paul and Barnabas are going to protest as vehemently as possible the fact that they're gods. And we saw the same thing back in chapter 3. Back in Acts 3, when the people were amazed at what Peter had done, he did the same thing in verse 12. We'll look at verse 11. It says, while he was clinging, and that's the lame guy who could now walk, clinging to Peter and John, all the people ran together to them at the so-called portico of Solomon, full of amazement. But when Peter saw this, he replied to the people, men of Israel, why are you amazed at this? Or why do you gaze at us as if by our own power or piety we had made him walk? So the miracle is never, ever intended to glorify the messenger, the one doing the miracle. It's meant to glorify God. So two notes about miracles we can keep with us from this event. Now we get to the sermon in verse 14 through 18. And before we go into the sermon, I want to look at Paul's approach to the sermon. And it's going to be different, as I said before. His approach to proclaiming the gospel is determined or modified by his audience. And we see that in Paul quite a bit in the book of Acts. Remember back in Antioch, look at chapter 13 and verse 16. When Paul got to Antioch, and remember, in Antioch, he's down in the synagogue. What's his approach going to be in the synagogue? In verse 16, it says, Paul stood up and motioning with his hand, said, Men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen. So the people he was talking to were familiar with the Old Testament, both groups, the Jews, Israel, and the God-fearers, who were the Gentiles who were attracted to Judaism. Both of these groups were familiar with the Old Testament. Now, his approach then is going to be the Old Testament, the Scriptures. Look at verse 26. When we get the audience again here, it says, Brethren, sons of Abraham's family, and those among you who fear God. Again, the God-fearers and the Jews. In verse 27, For those who live in Jerusalem and their rulers, recognizing neither him nor the utterances of the prophets, which are read every Sabbath, fulfilled these by condemning him. And he's using the Scriptures for his argument. He said it was prophesied that they would condemn Christ, and here these guys did it, and they didn't even know it. And they read the Scriptures every Sabbath day. In verse 29, it says, When they had carried out all that was written concerning him, they took him down from a cross. Again, appealing to the Scriptures. Verse 33, God has fulfilled this promise to our children in that he raised up Jesus, as it is also written in the second Psalm, You are my son, today I have begotten you. In verse 41, again he quotes the Old Testament, Behold, you scoffers, and marvel and perish, for I am accomplishing a work in your days, a work which you will never believe, though someone should describe it to you. And he quotes the Old Testament. So when he goes down to the synagogues, and he has an audience of Jewish people and people familiar with the Old Testament, he appeals to the Scriptures to prove his point. And he says, you know, all the things that the Old Testament said about Messiah, Jesus was the one they were talking about. So that's his approach. Now, in Athens, when we get to Athens in chapter 17, look at Acts chapter 17, in verse 21. Acts 17, 21, Now all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. Always looking for something new in the way of philosophy, Greek philosophy. Now, verse 22, So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, To an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. You see the difference in his approach there? Now he's talking to Athenians, and their thing is Greek philosophy. So he says, he appeals to their Greek philosophy. He says, Here's your God. I'm going to explain what that means to you. And he approaches that way. Now in Lystra, and again, remember in Lystra, his audience is purely pagan now. They're not God-fearers. They're not Jews. They're just pagans. He's going to appeal to their natural revelation of God. Look at chapter 14 and verse 15. Now he quotes the Old Testament here, but he's appealing to natural revelation, isn't he? At the last part of the verse, he says that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. So they can look around and see heavens and earth and see and all that's in them. That's natural revelation, and that's how Paul is going to approach the gospel in Lystra. Now, the thing to remember when Paul's approaches vary is that his approach may vary from Greek philosophy, natural revelation, to Old Testament. His message never varies. It's just his approach, how he gets to the message, how he gets to the understanding of the person who he's talking to. Now, he's talking to a group of pagans. He doesn't go in and say, you know, all those prophecies in the Old Testament, that, you know, he would have got blank looks had he done that. He says, God made heavens and the earth. Look around you. Look at the heavens and the earth. There has to be a creator here. So he appeals to their natural revelation. Now, Francis Schaeffer, the Christian philosopher, he likes to say that there's always some point of contact when you're dealing with an unbeliever that you can get them to understand, that you can come to. And that's kind of what Paul does here. He always tries to find some way that he can find a common ground with them. Because just as bad as him going into to this crowd at Lystra and talking about the Old Testament, if we go up to an unbeliever in our culture today and say, Jesus Christ died for your sins, a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times, you might as well be talking Hebrew, because they have no concept or idea of what you're talking about. And Paul kind of works into this. Now, let's talk a little about natural revelation, because that's what he's going to use here. First, the definition of natural revelation is that which may be learned about God from his creation, apart from his word. Now, we can learn things about God apart from God's word, from his creation. And those things are accurate. We can't learn all about God, but we can learn things about God. Now, there's an assumption behind this definition. That assumption is simply this, that the physical universe is the result of a creative act by a real, personal God. That's what Paul means in chapter 14, verse 15, when he's talking about turning away from these vain things to a living God. There's a real God, you know it? And he made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. So he's saying the creation comes from a real, living, personal God. Now, the antithesis of natural revelation in our culture is the theory of evolution. They say no creative hand at all. Time plus chance created everything that you see. Let's look at Psalm 19 for a second. Psalm 19, you can subtitle Psalm 19, The Skies and the Scriptures, talks about God's revelation to man. And God's revelation to man is the skies and the scriptures. Breaks down into three parts. Part one talks about natural revelation. And that's the part we're going to look at because that's the part we're interested in up in Acts, because that's what Paul is going to appeal to the pagans down at Lystra with. And this is verse 1 through 6 of the psalm. Part two is going to talk about God's special revelation, and that is the scriptures. That's verse 7 through 10. Look at verse 7, for example. It says, the law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the law of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. So he turns from natural revelation to special revelation. And then verse 11 through 14 of that psalm, just to finish up the outline, talks about the response of the psalmist. Verse 12, for example, who can discern his errors? Acquit me of hidden faults. Also keep track of your servant from presumptuous sins. So that'll be the reaction. But let's look at that first section that talks about natural revelation. And the first thing we find in verse 1 is the message. There's a message to creation. Psalm 19:1 says the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Now, sometimes we look at natural revelation, the physical universe, we look at the universe around us and we think of magnificence. It's a magnificent universe. It's incredibly, unsearchably complex and vast, and it's magnificent. But you know what? That's not the point of the universe. It's not really the point of the physical universe. The point of the physical universe is it has a message for us. It says the heavens are telling of the glory of God. So rather than magnificence of the universe, the psalmist is looking behind that to saying, wow, that must have been really somebody who created it then. So he's looking behind the magnificence to the message of the universe. And that message is the glory of God. Now we're going to find out, and we'll look at Romans 1 in a second, that man's response to this glorious message is one of two things. He'll, one, worship the Creator rather than the creation, or the creation rather than the Creator. And two, he'll explain it away as being merely an accident, a fluke. Look at Job 31, and you can see the danger of that attitude of worshiping the creation rather than the Creator. In Job 31, it tells, what exactly does that mean if I worship the creation? Verse 26 says, if I have looked at the sun when it shone, or the moon going in splendor, and my heart became secretly enticed, and my hand threw a kiss from my mouth. And that means in worship. What does that mean? Well, that too would have been an iniquity calling for judgment, for I would have denied God above. So any worship of the created universe is denying God. So man's response, and we'll get to that in Romans 1 in a minute, is going to be to deny, will be to worship creation, or in our culture, explain it away as merely a product of chance plus time. Now back at Psalm 19, in verse 2, verse 1, we had the message of natural revelation, the message, the glory of God. Verse 2 is the continuity. Verse 2 says, day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. So day after day, night after night, the universe is always there for everyone to see, and it proclaims the glory of God. Now it's kind of interesting that he says, the night to night reveals knowledge. Did you ever stop and think that up until recently in the history of mankind, if we hadn't had night, there'd be a lot about the universe that they wouldn't have known? You can't see the stars in the daytime. You can't see the vastness of the universe. So one of the purposes of having night is what? To reveal knowledge. You can look out at the night sky, and that night sky has a message for you. It has knowledge. It says there's a glorious God behind this. Verse 3 and 4 of Psalm 19 talk about the medium of this natural revelation, and there's a paradox in these verses. It's wordless speech. In verse 3 it says, there is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth. Now, line is in verse 4, and I have a marginal note in mine. In verse 4 it says, another reading is sound. I think sound fits a little bit better. Cry, sound, some other synonym for speech. The Septuagint, and you'll remember the Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. The Septuagint in this verse has the word thongos for line, and thongos means a clear or distinct sound. So the people who translated the Septuagint took it to mean a sound. So what he's saying is there's no speech, there are no words, their voice is not heard, but their sound has gone out through all the earth. So natural revelation, the physical universe, communicates very clearly. The sound has gone out through all the earth, even though there's no voice, no language, no speech. So since language, this is kind of interesting, if language isn't required, then revelation, natural revelation, is not limited by language. So even people, you know, I get tongue-tied sometimes and my language goes south, so to speak, sometimes. But if you go out in the night sky, you know what? You don't need language. You just look up and you see the glory of God. It's not limited by language. So the other thing you can say about that is that it's the only exception to the judgment at Babel, isn't it? Because you don't need language. Everybody can see creation. Last part of verse 4, the scope of this natural revelation through verse 6 shows that it's universal. Their utterances to the end of the world, in them he has placed a tent for the sun, which is a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. It rejoices as a strong man to run his course. Its rising is from one end of the heavens, and its circuit to the other end of them. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. So talking about universal revelation. So that's natural revelation. Now we won't continue the psalm. We'll come back and catch this another time and talk about special revelation in verse 7 and following. That's the Bible. But these things we can say about natural revelation, and that's what Paul's going to appeal to. But before we go back to Acts, look at Romans chapter 1, and we just need to look at man's response to this natural revelation. Remember, revelation, the physical universe, has a message. That message is the glory of God. What does man do to that? What's his response? Romans 1, verse 18. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." Suppress the truth. They hold it down. Verse 19 tells us that man has accurate and clear information about God. It says, "Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them." And in verse 20, it says that natural revelation is always sufficient to condemn man. That's enough revelation for man to know there's a God. But what does man do with it? Verse 18, he holds it down. He suppresses it. Verse 20 says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." So natural revelation is sufficient to condemn man. Now, when I say that, sometimes I get the response, well, if that's the case, is natural revelation sufficient to save man? If man sees the stars and he says there must be a wonderful, personal, living God behind that, is that enough to save man? And my answer to that is always, well, it doesn't matter. Man doesn't do that. Man sees natural revelation and says, I'll worship the sun, I'll worship the stars, I'll worship a tree, I'll worship a person. Man doesn't respond to natural revelation. That's Romans 1. So that's kind of a trick answer, I guess, to that question. But Romans 1 tells it Man suppresses the truth. Now back to Acts chapter 14. We have the basis for Paul's approach here now. And Paul's going to appeal to natural revelation in his sermon, and he's going to teach these pagans something that the Jews and the God-fearers already knew about God. So he's stepping back a step. He's saying, these guys don't know the Old Testament. They don't know about God like the Jews and the God-fearers do. Now, the Jews already knew that God was a one God. They knew that there was one God. So did the God-fearers. In fact, that's one of the things that attracted them to Judaism. They knew that he was responsible for creation. Now, Paul tells these pagans that in verse 14. Or verse 15, it says, men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you, and preach the gospel to you, that you should turn from these vain things to a living God, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. Now, the first thing we note about Paul's sermon, it's going to be a correction. And he's going to correct several false assumptions or several mistakes that these pagans make. And the first one is the correction of their views as to who the apostles are. He's going to correct them that they think the apostles are actually worthy of worship themselves. And he says in verse 14, but when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard of it, that is, that they wanted to offer a sacrifice to him, they tore their robes and rushed out into the crowd. Now, tearing their robes probably doesn't do much for us. What does that mean? Did they run so fast they got it hooked on a nail or what? Actually, tearing their robes was a gesture of horror at blasphemy. That's what Jews did when they were really upset by blasphemy. They would tear their robes. Now, next, the apostles are going to correct the crowd as to the nature of their message. They're going to say, look, you guys, we're not proclaiming ourselves. We're proclaiming the gospel. And that's verse 15b. It says, we preach the gospel to you that you should turn from these vain things to a living God. And they go on to correct their assumptions about the nature of God. A living God. One God. He's one. He's living. And he's responsible for creation. One God. Remember, they had a whole bunch of gods. So they correct that. They correct as to the inaction of God in verse 16. Verse 16 says, in the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. Now, human viewpoint has two views on the inaction of God. God is letting, in verse 16, the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. There's two responses to that, according to human viewpoint. One is atheism. They look around, there's no God, can't be a God. The one artist, philosopher, who said, if there's a God, he's the devil. That's because you look around and you see bad things happening. God's inaction, and they take it to mean there's no God. Now, the second thing, an unbeliever or human viewpoint will say about the inaction of God is, one, he isn't there, or two, if he's there, he doesn't care. He just doesn't care about us. He's not doing anything. There was I don't know if any of you were, I was a science fiction buff when I was younger, and I read all the science fiction books, and there was an author named Kurt Vonnegut Jr., and he wrote a book called The Sirens of Titan, and in this book, and it's not a very edifying book, I wouldn't recommend it or anything, but I was a young man and not a believer, and he wrote this book, and in this book, they had a religion, and this guy started a religion, and his religion was called the Church of God, the Totally Indifferent. And that's kind of his idea of God, you know. Well, if there's a God, he must be completely indifferent to what's going on down here. Because he's not stepping in. He's not doing anything. Well, that's not true, of course, but that's human viewpoint. As to God in verse 16, permitting the nations to go their own ways. Now, what's the divine viewpoint on that? Well, a believer stops and says, wow, that's a matter of God's grace, you know it? He's given time. If God steps in, that's going to be the end of things. God, by letting man go his own way, is giving man time to become saved, to believe the gospel. So it's a matter of pure grace. Every breath that the unbeliever breathes is a matter of God's grace. It's more time for him to believe. Every breath the believer breathes is a matter of God's grace as well. So verse 16 is God's comment on human history. He permitted all the nations to go their own ways. What could possibly be worse than God's comment, letting man go his own way? And then in verse 17, Paul appeals to what we call common grace when he says, and yet he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. That's what we call common grace. What common grace means simply is this, that God does good things for everybody, regardless of their relationship to him. What a gracious God. Have you ever seen an unbeliever with talent? I've seen some incredibly talented unbelievers. That's a matter of God's common grace. He gives rain to everybody, not just believers. He gives fruitful seasons to everybody, not just believers. Common grace. And again, in verse 18, what's man's response to this? Even now, here's Paul. He's just explained to all these folks down in Lystra. He's just told them, we're guys just like you. God made the heavens and the earth. There's one God, a true living God, and we're just folks just like you, telling you the gospel. Verse 18, even saying these things with difficulty, they restrained the crowds from offering sacrifice to them. So can you see, and I can kind of get a feel for what Paul must have felt like. He goes through this sermon, he tells them about natural revelation, he appeals to it, tells them about common grace, and when he's done, they say, yeah, Paul, when can we kill the bulls now? You know, can we do the sacrifice now? I'm sure Paul just threw up his hands. You know, even saying these things with difficulty, they restrained the crowds from offering sacrifice to them. Next time, we'll see a once-in-a-lifetime experience for Paul. And that will be they will stone him. And remember, I said earlier that when they stone people, they didn't do it until they were black and blue. They did it until they were dead. And verse 19 says, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city. They thought he was dead. So it wasn't like they said, well, we'll stop a little short on Paul. They actually thought he was dead. And we'll begin to see next week some of the background for the book of Galatians and how incredibly fickle these Galatians, and remember we're still in the Galatian territories, how changeable and fickle these guys are. And we'll pick that up next week. Father, thank you again for your inspired church history in the book of Acts. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.